Olympic. again, you're listening to CITR Radio, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and the Nerd War to Human Serviette radio show. And you just heard Victoria's House of Commons with Way Down South. And before that, Death Sentence with RCMP, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada's Death Sentence with RCMP. And then to begin the show, we played you I Want a Woman from the Soviet Union, the greatest song ever recorded by Death Sentence from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And speaking of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, you're listening to the Nerd War, the Human Serviette radio show from CITR, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And today on the Nerd War, the Human Serviette radio show, hopefully, touch wood, an interview with Dave Neal of The Villains, the legendary Vancouver ska band, The Villains. Of course, Dave now is in Skaboom, who are playing this Sunday night at the Wise Hall with Montreal, Quebec's The Kingpins, Rumbletone and Scotty Productions presents. So check that out if you want some ska action and a little bit of knowledge on the Davester. Should be coming up shortly as soon as I establish contact with him. So I thought in the mood to put you guys in the mood of Vancouver rock circa 1980s. We had a bit of the House of Commons actually from Victoria, and of course some Death Sentence from Vancouver. Of course, Death Sentence at one time stapled their balls to a picnic bench in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. They were escaping their girlfriends on a weekend of debauchery after getting a whole bunch of money for lip-syncing an Agent Orange song on 21 Jump Street. Yeah, if you go through the 21 Jump Street catalog, look for the episode where there's some punks involved and there's a band, Death Sentence, lip-syncing an Agent Orange song, because 21 Jump Street were too cheap to pay for such great Death Sentence songs like I Want a Woman from the Soviet Union. I'm not sure what Death Sentence really thought of The Villains or other bands that played that type of music in Vancouver, but I thought I would expose you to some just to get you in the mood, as I mentioned. And right now we have coming up the B-Sides, which actually is a complete, probably 360 from the good old House of Commons and Death Sentence. And then hopefully some Villains and some more Villains and some more Villains. And again, this Sunday night at the Wise Hall, Skaboom and the Kingpins. But right now, the B-Sides, Vancouver music from the 1980s. Not that there wasn't music then, it's just maybe you didn't know that there was this music. Well, you probably did know there was this music, but I didn't, because I didn't discover it till, well, 1986. We'll be right back. Again, you're listening to CITR Radio, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and the Nardwuar to Human Serviette Radio Show. And that was just the B-sides with Bedtime for Bonzo. And right now we have a special guest on the line. Hello, caller. Are you there?
Hello, Nardwuar. Dave Neal here from Skaboom.
How the hell are you, Dave?
I'm doing great, thanks very much.
Oh, actually, I should say right off the bat, who are you? Please explain. Who are you, Dave Neal?
Oh, I'm a bloke called Legs, and I play in a band called Skaboom. We're a seven-piece ska band. We've got three horns. We're a hot band. We love to play. We've been playing for years. What more do you want to know about me?
Well, you're playing this Sunday night, of course, at the Wise Hall with the Kingpins from Montreal.
Yeah, it's going to be a great gig. The Kingpins are a really fun, innovative ska band from Montreal. And we're a little bit more basic. We're a little bit more old-style, second-generation ska. But we just, we like to rock. We like to skank. And we like to party, sir.
And you've seen a lot of ska over the years, Dave. As I mentioned before you actually got on the air, you were in the influential combo The Villains, one of my favorite bands of all time.
Wow.
And you were in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, all throughout the 80s. And actually, I began the Nardwuar to Human Serviette radio show with Death Sentence. Then I played some House of Commons. Then I played some B-sides. What can you tell the people about the B-sides who we just played there?
The B-sides were a good bunch of Canadian guys. When we arrived in Canada from London in 1980, and the B-sides were the only ska band in Vancouver at that time. So they had they'd formed in 1980, and by the time we arrived, we're a load of London hooligans at the time. They were also playing ska. So they had a good sound. They played all the clubs we used to play. You know, they had a good following. They were a good band. People danced. That's what I remember about the B-sides.
That's a great explanation. Thank you, Dave Neal of Skaboom and The Villains. I was going to follow up the B-sides, but you thankfully did phone in, and thank you very much for phoning in. Of course, you're Dave Neal of Skaboom playing this Sunday night at the Wise Hall with the Kingpins. I was going to follow up the B-sides with a little bit of Maurice and the Clichés. Maurice and the Clichés, those guys. Now, were they ska?
They weren't really ska, but they were, again, similar era. You know, they were, I remember Maurice from 81, 82, and they were not so much ska, but they were definitely, in my mind, they had more of a pop feel, and again, a fun band, a good band to dance to.
So how did the Villains start exactly? You're from Ilford, England?
Ilford, yeah, the same as the black and white film. I was born in East London in Fryskate. And the Villains, we started in 1979 in London, and we came to Canada in 1980, basically just as a fun thing to do. We were illegal when we arrived. We had no papers. We just had guitars and just came. We played at the end of 1980 to February 1981, where we got arrested at Gary Taylor's Rock Bar, and we got thrown in prison, in Ocala prison, for being illegal. We spent a couple of weeks in prison, as well as the Royal Mounted Police Jail and the Vancouver City Police Jail. So we had a couple of weeks of time just for not being Canadians, and our crime was for playing ska music in Canada without the correct authorization. Anyway, so that was a fun roller coaster. We couldn't get off, but we had to do it. We were then asked to leave the country for 3 months while immigration sorted out our correct papers, and we came back in May 81, where we then did our first official gig in Canada, which was playing Ocala Penitentiary for the inmates. So that was a bit of a laugh. And then we just spent the next 6 years touring Canada and the States, and we were on work permits every 6 months. So what that meant is every 6 months we had to do at least 2 tours of Canada. So in 6 years, we did probably 24 tours of Canada coast to coast. So we toured like crazy. A lot of the other bands you've mentioned, you know, they did a few gigs, maybe 1 or 2 tours of Canada. But with the Villains, we were just we were non-stop touring for 6 years. You know, we played 1,900 gigs in Canada, which is a lot of gigs for any one band.
Almost sounds like a record of some sorts.
Well, maybe over that period, it probably was, and it was only because we had to. You know, we were often would get exhausted on tour, and you just want a week off. But if we stopped touring, we would have been asked to leave Canada, so we couldn't. And the funny thing was that as soon as we became legal in 1986, we stopped touring because we were exhausted.
And you, of course, are Dave Neal of Skaboom and of The Villains, and you're just mentioning a bit about The Villains right there. I was curious, though, back in Britain, did you play any gigs when you first formed in Britain? Because I heard also stories that you started in Vancouver and then moved to Britain and then moved back to Vancouver. Did you play any gigs in Britain? Did you release any records in Britain? Were you friends with any ska bands in Britain? Did you go to many ska gigs in Britain?
Yeah,
at that time?
Okay. Well, for me, yeah, basically the way the band formed is there was a guy called Count Steve who was an expert who was living in Vancouver. He came over to London where we formed The Villains. That's where we formed. We only played probably about 10 gigs in England. Gigs were quite hard to come by at that time for us. So we just played local pubs. Until Steve had the brainchild of saying, "Hey, people will love us in Canada. We've got to try it. We have to." So that's what we did, just on a whim, and it worked out really well. During the time, I joined my first ska band in England in 1977, and we did just a self compilation 6-song EP with that band. That was just a band called Scam, which is another ska-type band, but we just had a couple of thousand copies printed that we sold, you know, just local band. I saw a lot of bands in basically 78, 79, and 80 before I came out here. I saw a lot of the classic bands like Madness, The Specials, Bad Manners, English Beat, and I've seen them, you know, many times since then. You know, my history with ska is that I was brought up in East London in a place called Forest Gate, and the houses either side of me were Jamaicans. So we were a white family with 6 kids, poor, and either side of me we had Jamaican families who basically came to England in 66 when there was a massive emigration out of Jamaica to East London. Anyway, so they bought their reggae and they bought their original first wave ska. So I basically got into that as a teenager, dancing at school dances and at the youth club dances to the original ska with my black mates. And that led to me in the 70s joining a ska band that was a multiracial band. And, you know, we were just basically amateurs at that point, but we loved it. And that led to The Villains, and then that led ultimately to Skaboom, which is my latest band, which is playing at the YSL on Sunday the 6th. We formed in 1987, so Skaboom's been an entity now for, 16 years? We formed basically just because we loved playing the music.
Did Scam release any vinyl? You're saying that was the name of the band, Scam?
Yeah, S-K-A-M. We released a 12-inch six-song vinyl. That's what we did, and that was in end of 1978.
Has that ever been reissued or end up on any comps or anything like that, or have any of the songs been covered by other bands, or did you incorporate them into The Villains at all?
No, I didn't. I basically I left that band behind. It was a little more hardcore, and I didn't really agree with the politics of that band. They were a little bit more of a skinhead ska band, and basically basically, I joined the band simply because I love the music, whereas the a couple of the guys in the band were heavy into racism, and I was with the band for about 9 months, and I just decided that was not me at all.
I guess what I was wondering about the vinyl there was, Dave Neal, was in TGF magazine, Friday, January 2nd, 1981, there's an article called Villainous Skinheads Land in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And in the article it says the group's first single on Stiff Records, the same label the Pointed Sticks had, saw moderate success on the British charts. The single Lip Hop Fatty, a song about East London skinheads, wasn't released in North America because the band felt it had too much of a reggae ska beat to break our finicky AM market. Did you have a single on Stiff Records, or is that this maybe hype done by the writer?
That was sounds like 100% hype. The song Lip Up Fatty was made famous by Buster Bloodvessel.
Bad Manners.
And he had a hit with that in late 80s, and it also resurfaced again. So he's had two number one hits with that one song. And it's a song he wrote. The Villains did not write that song at all. So that is complete fabrication.
That was actually in your press kit, because I have a copy of the Villains press kit here.
Yeah.
And it's like right there in your press kit.
You got it.
Also, it goes on to say, the Villains have been playing for relatively sparse crowds after playing at an anti-nuke rally of 75,000 people in London. Did you ever play an anti-nuke rally of 75,000 people in London?
In the Villains, we did not. I definitely did not.
I thought that was kind of interesting, another sort of little hype thing. But I guess you need that information to get the people excited out there in Radio Land. And, of course, we're speaking here to the excited Dave Neal, who's excited to play with his band Skaboom this Sunday night at the Wise Hall with the Kingpins. And Dave was in the Villains. And, I mean, this really was exciting for me, Dave, because you guys are one of the first bands I actually saw. You just killed. You were just amazing. It's just like watching you guys. You were incredible. And I want to ask you about the skinhead connection. You mentioned about skinheads and weren't really into the politics. In Vancouver, you were really kind of billeted as skins. Like, there was a really big skin thing in Vancouver, i.e., you guys really played that up, at least in the press kit. And I quote, you know, ska music is the dance music, and the Villains are a dance band. The Villains are also a skinhead band. Ska music is very popular among the skinhead ranks in London. Skinheads, skins, or boot boys are a cult in United Kingdom that started in the early 1970s. They are one of the few skinhead groups to play ska music. What was it like kind of preaching this sort of skinheaddom with the Villains in Vancouver? Did you ever run into any trouble?
Yeah, we did run into trouble occasionally. Again, what it is with the whole skinhead thing, you know, I grew up this in East London, right, where it was most prevalent in Britain. So throughout my teens, that's when there were more skinheads in London than ever. And basically, there's two groups of skinheads. There's one which is a fascist skinhead, which is a racist skinhead. And there's another group of skinheads who don't have that political agenda. They don't have the hate in their hearts, okay? Basically, what is really weird, again, it stems back to the Jamaicans coming to England in 66, right? Like, in our neighborhood, you know, we had 20,000 Jamaicans come in that 1 year, right, in, you know, a small mile area. And basically, the skinheads, what they were doing originally is they were copying the black guys. The black guys came over, and they had the shaved head with just a quarter of an inch fuzz. That's what they had. And the skinheads wanted to be like these guys, so they copied them, they cut their hair off. And then basically, as time progressed, you have one faction of skinheads that basically, what happened with me is, you know, the best football players in my team were my black mates, right? So we hung out together, we went to the same dances, we listened to the same music, we danced together. You know, we had black girlfriends, we had white girlfriends. That's what we did. Then there was another faction of skinheads, which were the fascist, racist skinheads, who were scared of the blacks. And suddenly their wanting to beat up, all the immigrants, not just the black Jamaicans, it was the Pakistanis, it was the Indians, the East Indians. And that group went on to basically cause a lot of trouble, cause a lot of hatred. There's a lot of violence in London because of them. Houses were set on fire. There was awful shit happening. And there were new skinhead bands that would promote that fascist type of music. And basically, what I want to say is the villains were never that bad. We were never racist. You know, how can you be a racist when your best friends are black and Pakistani, right? When you grow up with them in school. But there was so I just want to put that on the record, is that was not our agenda at all.
When you moved to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, did you have any problems? You said you had a few problems. Were there many skinheads here already? Were you the first skinheads? Because you definitely were skinheads. Were there any racist skins that came to your gigs?
No.
Or was it a brand new thing?
No, it was wonderful. It was what would happen. It was great. You know, we do gigs like at Gary Taylor's, at the laundromat, Smiling Buddha in those days, late 1980s. And yeah, these skinheads would come up to you, and a lot of them, you know, they wore all the gear, right? And some of them were quite tough, and they looked mean, right? But what was wonderful is you could talk to these guys, right? You could say, how are you doing? And they're not going to smack you in the face. In London at the time, in the, 1980, you could walk down the street, and if you looked at a skinhead the wrong way, it'd smack you in the mouth, right? You'd get into a major fight with them. If there's more than one of them, they beat the shit out of you. So for me, it was really quite weird because I'd come to Canada and, you know, you'd see, like, maybe, you know, four skinheads coming up to you and you think, uh-oh, fuck, there's going to be trouble. But these guys are friendly and nice and they don't have the bitterness, the anger and the hatred that the racist skinheads, who they looked like, had in England.
And this was what year, perhaps?
This was in 1980, 80, 81.
So you guys came to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, as the villains. How long did it take to get going? Because it looks like you started pretty much right away. What was the secret just to get going, to get the bookings and stuff? Was that hard?
It wasn't that hard. We were just very, very fortunate. We were fortunate in that on the second day here, we went down to Gary Taylor's, which was a rock room. They had a band cancel. They booked us for 3 days immediately. From that, suddenly word got around that there was this new English ska band, and there hadn't been an English ska band in Canada at that time. The Specials played here once in 81, but when we were there in 80, there'd never been this thing, and yet in the charts in Britain at that time, basically in the top 10, there were six ska bands, right? So people in the know knew of ska was happening big in England, but no one had seen a British ska band, and here was us, the little villains. We'd come in, and people said, we want to see this English ska band. They may be fun, right? And it turns out we were, right? So that's what happened. And then after that gig, we were lucky in that, again, opposite that was a venue called The Cave, where James Brown used to play and people like that. And again, the following week, we went and met the manager of The Cave, and he basically said, sure, come on in. You know, you can do 3 days. And so we played at The Cave with the Pointed Sticks. That's what we did.
And it was like instant connection with the audience too, wasn't it? Because you ended up getting quite a huge following really quick.
It was fabulous. What I loved about Canada, you know, like being an immigrant, never been here before, is that we play music and we play it at our full intensity, which I've always loved to do. But the crowds would just pick up on it, and they'd want to dance. They'd want to get into it. You know, they were, for a musician, you know, Canadians are, you know, to me, I thought I was in heaven. I really did. I thought, wow, these guys want to listen to me. They want to dance, and they really want to have fun. So it was like landing in a wonderful, mythical place where people liked you, right?
How did the other bands regard you? Because I understand there was a bit of resentment out there from the other local bands. Like, it's cool you played with the Pointed Sticks and stuff, but did you have problems with some of the other local bands?
There was a little bit of jealousy around. There was. But when you actually talk to a lot of the musicians, I honestly believe that the villains were a huge influence. I recently talked to a couple of musicians from that era, and they basically said before the villains, their band was one way. After the villains, everything changed. Because when we came to Canada, the bands I saw in that first 3 months basically got on stage and stood there in front of their mics and sang.
And you guys looked really unique, too, because you all had your shirts off and your shaved heads, and you were sweating away. It was pretty amazing, wasn't it?
It was back then. It's funny. Back then, it was amazing. Today, when you see the same type of high-energy ska punk bands, they're way more outrageous than we were, right? You know, you've probably seen Chili Peppers in their heydays wearing nothing but socks on their willies, right? Right, which is pretty outrageous. And they will be energetic. The early days of some of the other ska bands where the whole band would just dive off the stage and, you know, surf the crowds. They're a little bit more outrageous than we were, but we came and our attitude was we came to give a show. We're going to get on stage and we're going to give it and we're going to sweat and we're going to hopefully get the audience with us so we can have a great time. That was our attitude. At the time, it was pretty different than what was happening with the regular Canadian rock bands at the time. Whereas I think today, you know, I've seen some young bands and, you know, they've really impressed me with their energy.
Here's a bit of resentment expressed through words.
Yes.
A lot of people in town had expressed annoyance at the villains billing themselves as British ska sensations because it implied that their fame accompanied them from Britain. However, as I reported in this column last fall, two members of the band had resided in Canada for a year or so, while the rest of their friends apparently had come over to put together their ska cover band away from the British music press and the competition, Madness, The Special Selector, and The Beat. You can't argue with their sheer entertainment value. And, as I also mentioned last week, they use their British style hype with more flair than any local bands. However, with their conspicuousness their conspicuousnesses, they got caught. The two older residents had their immigration papers, but the others were allegedly playing without working papers. Hearings took place earlier this week. So I guess that's talking about when you were actually busted. Do you think that you were narked on? Is that how come you got busted? Like, how did that all come about?
We don't actually know the truth on that, unfortunately. All I know is that we were playing Gary Taylor's. We're on our second set. It was after midnight on a Thursday night, and suddenly along the back wall there were basically 12 cops, city police, and then in front of them walked five guys in suits and long raincoats. And we're playing, and the place is packed with skinhead punks, college students, right? That's it. That was our crowd at the time. And we're looking at these people on the back wall thinking, what the hell? Why are they there? And then basically the plainclothes guys, as we found out they were afterwards, and the cops all rushed the stage and they clamped handcuffs on the band and arrested us off stage mid-set. That's what happened. Then they took us outside and they put us into the paddy wagon. And then from the paddy wagon they took us to the city jail for the first night. Then the next night, because the city jail was full with 50 drunks, that's where we spent the night. We were then transferred to the RLCMP jail, where we spent the next night with 30 drunks and criminals. And then the next night, we basically, us and 50 others, all got transported to Ocala Penitentiary, where we stayed there until we were released on bail 2 weeks later.
This is quite an interesting little quote here where it says something like, due to the lack of services caused by the QP strike in Vancouver, they were transferred to Ocala Penitentiary. So the QP strike caused you to go to Ocala then?
Yeah, basically, all it is they were, because all the cleaning staff were on strike, they put 50 of us into these large drunk tanks, right? So here I am, dressed up, in all my stage gear, which was, you know, at the time was pretty outrageous, right? In jail with 50 drunks, and criminals, you know, people puking all night, and that was my first night in jail.
Now, how did you get through all that? How did you guys end up coming back to Canada? Because nowadays, something like happened, you'd like never be able to come back to Canada.
Basically, we've been very fortunate, right? So what happened is...
It like in Ocala, I should say? First off, what was it like in Ocala for a few days as a skinhead?
It was very scary. It was also very entertaining. And lots of weird stuff happened. It depends how much detail you want to know, but...
Lots of detail. Please, go ahead.
Well, okay. Well, you get to Ocala, you're totally stripped, right? You're totally hosed down with this guy's... With the screws have all got guns, you're told what to do, you have to do it. Full inspection of your body parts for any miscellaneous crap. You then stand there dripping wet for 2 hours while they get your clothes together. Then basically you're issued clothes. You go upstairs, you have cold food, and you're all put into individual cells. Basically then the day would begin with in the shower in the morning. And you go in the shower, and we were lucky enough on our particular cell row to have a transsexual candy. So then basically you begin the day by watching the other thuggish prisoners abusing this beautiful transsexual woman, and you couldn't do anything about it. But as I say, it was entertaining. And she basically preferred to stay with the men and be abused, rather than to go in with the women where they would scratch her to bits. So that's why she was in the men's prison. So that was how we woke up. From then we just had cold eggs, cold bacon for breakfast, then exercise, then back in your room, locked up again until lunch. So it was pretty basic stuff. Other good things that happened is the warden's daughter had been at Gary Taylor's the nights we were arrested. So on the fourth night in prison, we basically were invited up to the warden's office where he gave us a full turkey dinner, and his daughter and two of her friends were there to meet the band. So that here I am in prison, right? So it's pretty amazing stuff.
How did you get through all the immigration problems, though? Did you have to hire a lawyer?
No, we didn't. All we did is to get out of jail in the 2 weeks, we basically all had to pay $10,000. Canadian. So we'd found a manager by that point, so he asked all his friends to help raise the monies to get us out. So we got out of jail. Then we had to wait another week until the court case. We went into the court, and my judge was a wonderful fellow called John, who was an ex-Jamaican. He's a black guy. This guy knew the history of reggae. He knew the history of ska, and he basically asked the prosecuting officer, who's the guy who arrested me and handcuffed me off stage, why he'd put me in prison and two jails for over 2 weeks for singing ska. And the prosecutor said, well, Judge, this guy is obviously a skinhead, he's obviously racist, he's obviously violent, that's what I did. And the judge said, well, how do you know that for a fact? And the prosecuting officer could not answer. It was silent. So then the judge asked me, why did you come to Canada? So I said, hey, to play ska. That's what I love. And he said, are you a violent man? I said, no, I hate violence. He said, are you a racist? I said, you've got to be joking. He said, have you any criminal record? I said, absolutely not. So he just then took the prosecutor aside and said, you're going to see me afterwards in my chambers. It is a crime for you to waste Canadian government money locking up a guy for singing ska music and reggae music. This case is a load of bullshit. So he then came back to me and he just said, look, you've got 24 hours to get out of the country. If you leave within 24 hours, I will allow you back. And here's my card. If you need any help coming back into the country, contact me because I love ska music. And that's the truth.
How did you get back into the country? Like, how hard was it from there to get back in the country? I heard a rumor that you guys all got married to Canadian girls to help expedite the process.
Yeah, but here's another funny thing for you now, Bob. What happened there was that, yeah, we got out of the prison, right? And my manager had arranged for these girls, and so I married a woman I'd never even met
now,
before.
Let's just go back for a second. Your manager had arranged for these girls. Was that Dan Tolan,
yeah,
your manager?
Yeah.
Whatever happened to Lucky Dan Tolan?
Oh, Lucky Dan Tolan is now officially Dan Cowan, which is his real name. And he's now back in the country, and he's now a businessman. He's doing very well. He was into promoting concerts, and that's what he's been doing his whole life, so he's still doing that. So he's doing very well, and he's also legal now.
So where was he originally from?
He's from the U.S.
So when you stepped out of the prison, there was the girl of your dreams that you were going to marry, that Dan had arranged for you to marry, right?
That was actually 3 days later, and again, we went down to this is all history, so I can tell it all. We went down to the courthouse downtown. And there to meet me was my wife, Bubbles, my wife-to-be, I should say. And we all got married one after the other to these girls. I didn't know my wife, and my drummer, Skankin' Steve, he didn't know his wife, but my bass player, Tommy, he was able to marry the girl who he'd been dating for 2 months. And he went on to have two kids with that girl. Anyway, with my wife, I basically I kissed her that day and then didn't see her again for 4 years. And then I met up with her in 1988, and she asked me if I would divorce her, so I did.
Did you guys actually have to leave the country, though? Did you actually have to go back to Britain for a bit?
Absolutely. No, we were out of the country from February 21st, 81, until May 4th, 81. And the judge, in each case, the judge told us we had 24 hours to leave. It was just, for me, it was very hard because my court case ended on a Friday night at 5 p.m., and in 1980, there were no bank machines, and the banks were always closed on Saturday. So then I had to find $900 to get a one-way plane back to London. I had to get out of the country. That was the one requirement for me ever to come back. And anyway, that's another story that I cannot tell you on air, how we managed to do that.
And you are Dave Neal of The Villains, now of Skaboom, playing this Sunday night with the Kingpins at the Wise Hall. Now, at that time, Dave, had the Life of Crime EP, which is a classic, which is my favorite, which totally inspired me, had that come out at that point? That's your 4-song vinyl EP, The Life of Crime.
Villains. No, we basically had recorded it, but it had not come out. We didn't actually release it until May 1980. When we came back, that's what happened on that one.
When you returned to England, did people know of you guys anymore from what had happened in Canada? Because this was big news in Vancouver. I think this story said it's not often that a local band makes it on the hourly news. You know, this is a big story.
It was fun because, again, another thing that happened in prison is that we called C-Fox, right? And who were playing just one of our demos, not one of the songs of Life of Crime. It was just a tape of one of the songs on Life of Crime. They were playing ska music on, they had an indie hour there on C-Fox in 1980. Anyway, so when you get to prison, you're allowed to make one call. So my call was to C-Fox, and they put me on air for a 20-minute phone call from Ocala Prison. That was in, that's February 1980 for you.
That was a good choice.
I thought so at the time. Again, with our band, it's funny because you know, we had a lead singer at the time. His name was Count Steve, and Count Steve was a fantastic scam artist. He was the original ska DJ on your radio station,
CITR, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
That's the one. 1979 to 1980, Count Steve was the ska DJ. That's what he did.
Wow!
You betcha. And exactly, he had been there for some time, and then he came to England, and in England, we formed The Villains. And once we'd formed, we'd done the gigs, we came back. My first time in Canada was November 1980. That's when I came back with the band. So all we'd done in England is we rehearsed, we'd played gigs, and we'd written songs.
Well, the Life of Crime EP, on the back, you thank Pete at Bumber Sound Studio. What was that?
Oh, yeah, basically that was a studio we'd done demos. We'd done our demos, and we're just thanking our sound guy at the studios. That's what we're doing.
How many copies of the EP were made? How was it distroed? And did you get any feedback from England or other bands?
Yeah, no, we did. We were back, it was actually pressed in April 2001 while I was back. And I was down in East London, and Steve, who did not get kicked out of the country because he was... He had lived in Canada for about 18 months. He basically sent me 100 copies. I distributed that around East London to all the, what I know as today, there would be like independent type record stores and skinhead record stores and a couple of the skinhead clothing stores in the East End that had a small record stack. And yeah, no, it sold out, and people liked it. There were a couple of local college stations in London that were actually playing that throughout 1981, and people were loving it. It's funny, over the years, you know, this is going back, you're going back so far, you know, it's hard for me to remember this stuff, but I've had knowledge that people have heard that particular album in Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Holland, Germany, Czechoslovakia, and it's all been played on radio stations. So it's quite amazing that just a little EP that we made in Vancouver, we actually made 5,000 copies. We did 1,000 pressing 5 times. So we did the first pressing, we sold out. So we ordered another 1,000. And we kept doing that until we'd actually sold 5,000 copies of that thing. And all we did is we just sold it at gigs, and we provided it to the independent-style record stores at the time in every city we went through on our tour. Because we were touring so much, we were able to sell a lot of gigs and through these independent record stores.
Who is the band The Snacks, or who were The Snacks? Because you thank The Snacks on the back of the Life of Crime EP.
Is it something else? Is it saying thank you to somebody else and for the snacks? Or
I'm not sure. I thought it was just The Snacks. Maybe it just says for The Snacks. I'm not sure. I thought it might have been a band, The Snacks.
Yeah, it's probably Tom, who we call Jockstrap, our sax player. His auntie would always. She was Scottish, right? And she'd always bake us these Scottish delicacies before the gigs, because she thought we would look too skinny. So she was just like a doting auntie, and she always wanted to feed us up. So before the gigs, she'd come and she'd give us everything from haggis to anything home-baked Scottish goods that she could think of. So I think that's what that's referring to.
And you are Dave Neal of The Villains, also of Skaboom, playing this Sunday night at the Wise Hall with the Kingpins. With the Kingpins. We've got to mention the Kingpins. With the Kingpins from Montreal. What do you think of the Kingpins?
I think they're great. I think they're a great ska band. I saw them last year, and very, very impressive.
And you guys were very impressive, too, way back when. I just can't overestimate or underestimate the importance of The Villains. And I have a little clip here from The New Music. Do you remember the TV show The New Music? Do you ever remember being on The New Music?
Yeah, no, I have videos at home, Narbwa. I have about 3 hours of videos from 1980 through 86 of every different TV station we went on in Canada and the States. So I've got that one at home.
And this is a little clip, and I'm just going to play it. I don't know if you can just hold on for a few minutes. Hopefully you'll be able to hear it. If not, it'll be 3 minutes of blank. But this illustrates just how amazing you guys were. And there's a couple songs in this actual clip that I'm not quite familiar with myself. But here it is. This is like The Villains live at probably 1980, 1981, on one of your trips to Toronto, as profiled on The New Music.
musicians have been called the blues brothers of modern ska. Here they are with National Bank.
Yeah, we're gonna rock the National Bank today and in last one. We're gonna rock the National Bank. Oh, what a pretty sight we're gonna see. We look sharp, we look sharp. We look left and right to make a sound. No one was there, it was clear. We look sharp, we look sharp. We look left and right to make a sound. No one was there, it's a year.
It's hard not to enjoy a band that gets you up dancing. The Villains, an English skinhead ska band who now call Vancouver home, were the sensation of this Toronto media party with their up-tempo form of Jamaican reggae rock. Ska first gained popularity in North America through the music of English bands such as The Specials, Madness, and The Beat. And I asked Chief Villain Count Steve what happened to the ska scene.
It's reviving again. You know, it's never really gone down in England, but we're in a crusade in Canada, you know.
Pardon me?
The ska band's still in the top 10 at the moment. If you look at the top English top 10, you find the ska band's right up there pushing it strong.
Why is it that we don't get more of it over here?
I think we're just, like to Canada, like to North America, just breaking out that sort of plastic idea, man. And yeah. Like to the... From Leo, I'm based in what's happened since Vancouver. We came the whole way right through Canada. It's been the same sort of vibe as tonight, eh? There's nothing else to do but dance.
Call it like an adventure, if you like. We're just, you know, over having a good time.
Johnny lives for his motor car. He cleans it every day. He goes so far. Johnny lives for his motor car. He drives it every day. It goes so fast. I never had nothing, oh no no no, till I met you, saw music. No interest in our app, oh no no.
Do you remember any of that there, Dave?
I remember, it's funny because I was just playing that tape to my son. And so I remember all of that. The first song, National Bank, is funny because when we were in the prison, that's when it was decided that we were going to release a song called Life a Crime. The cool part about that was we were talking to a lot of, you know, these were real criminals. These are guys who had killed people, who had raped people, and we're just listening. I'm one of those guys that likes to listen to people's stories, and these guys were telling me about their lives. So there was at that point, being arrested was the inspiration for Life of Crime. At that point, we wrote songs. That song, National Bank, We're Gonna Rob the National Bank, I wrote that after talking to someone in prison. The Life of Crime song was basically written about not someone in prison, but just one of our friends who had been in and out of prison his whole life, and that's how he was gonna be. After the prison thing, we wrote another song that's not on that particular thing called Doing Time. We wrote this whole, probably about 12 songs on a life of crime theme. That's what we did.
Did National Bank ever get released? Because that's a great tune.
Yeah, I've got way better copies of it, actually, than that. I could definitely let you have a copy of. But no, it never got released. It's funny, a lot of my, a lot of what I considered my fun songs never got released. Basically, after the Life of Crime, we got picked up by a company called Attic in 1984, and they basically told us that what we were doing was never going to get anywhere, but they'd sign us to do a pop album, right? Anyway, so we basically, with our Villains Go Crazy album, we basically... We did a little bit of ska in there, but it definitely changed the whole mood and flavor and essence. The actual essence of the Villains was not in that album.
Because you had some great other songs, like Wrigley's Gum Up Your Bum.
Oh, I love that. I know, that was a classic.
How did that song go exactly, Dave Neal?
Well, I can sing it to you.
Yeah, if you could. That was just watching you do that is incredible, that song. Like, that was life-changing for a young child.
how old was you when you saw us, Nadwa?
Well, it wasn't actually me. I just heard through it, through the grapevine. I was fairly young, probably like 15, but I think my friend was 12 and saw you doing that.
Yeah.
The Wrigley's Gum Up. What was the deal on that song? The Wrigley's Gum Up Your Bum?
Yeah, it was just, yeah, it was something I wrote. I admit I wrote this. it was just one of those throwaway songs, fun songs. You know when people are pissing you off or they're just being acting like wankers, you basically just want to say to them, "Oh, go stick a bit of gum up your bum, you wanker." So that's basically the essence of that song. And I can sing the song to you. It basically goes, "Wrigley's gum, you stick it up your bum, and then you chew it." That's the melody for you. But have you seen Skaboom lately, Nardwa?
No, I have not. Do you guys do that one?
We don't do that one. We do a lot of, we do ska music. We do Life of Crime. We do other villain songs from, like 25 years ago. We do that. As well as doing a lot of our own new songs. I'd like to talk a little bit more about Skaboom, right? What we are, right? Because this is what we're doing now rather than my history back in 79.
Yeah, we're just working up to that. Of course, you are Dave Neal of Skaboom playing this Sunday night with the Kingpins. I guess I was just working up for that. And I'm just going quickly back to that little new music clip on the wall of the venue we were playing in Toronto. It looked like it might have been the Horseshoe Tavern. I saw a little sign that said, "Cheesy, I've Got Your Socks." Was that another song?
No, it wasn't. Cheesy was our roadie. He's a guy called Barry McBride, who was another Scottish fella. And basically, he's one of these guys who never changed his socks. So it was just a fun little thing. For that particular thing you played was a promo party. It was the release of our Life of Crime album. And all we did then is we brought in some pearly kings and queens from the East End of London, right, to do their thing. We set up a fish and chip stall. What else did we do? We just tried to give it the feel of an East End of London bar for anyone who wanted to come to say hello to us.
Looked like it went over great.
It was fun. It was fun. It was. I've got the full tape of that at home. It's basically like an hour. Well, no, about half hour long tape I've got of that. And
you were Dave Neal of Skaboom, and of course at one time of the Villains. You'll never get the Villains out of your blood there, Dave Neal. Speaking of other villains, as I was playing that little clip, the sax wailing there on National Bank, Duncan from CITR, a DJ here, came running into the DJ booth saying, "Is the sax player a teacher? Because I think he might have been my teacher at Richmond High."
He was. That's Jock Strap, alias Tom Perry. He basically, when Tom finished with the Villains in 1986, and he then went back to what he used to do, which was be a computer science teacher. And so from around 1987 to current day, Tom is teaching in the Richmond School District.
I remember a few of my other friends seeing the Villains and then hearing that the saxophone player was a high school teacher, and it kind of made them a bit feeling weird, just the guy in the Villains. Did that get out there? Were you trying to hide that?
No.
No.
No, it was fun.
I mean, did he see his students and stuff when he was playing live?
Oh, yeah. No, we do a lot of underage gigs. Like, at the time, there were lots of places to play.
Lots of high schools. That's where I saw you, at high schools on the North Shore. You played tons.
Yeah, we played those, and we played, like, the Soft Rock Cafe on West 4th, which was an all-age gig. And they're probably some of my most memorable and most fun gigs, because we get these kids in there from 14 to 20, right? But the place would be overpacked. It was only meant to hold, say, like 200 people, and we'd squeeze 400 kids in there, and the place would rock. People would just skank, and the walls would sweat, and the energy was just so positive. And so I just got such incredible memories of those type of gigs.
Do you remember any super fans from that era? Like ones dressing up in a full mod regalia? Because I remember once in grade 8, my buddies were going to go see you guys play. We're going to go to the Soft Rock and see the Villains, but I never was picked up to go and see the Villains, so I remained a fan of Cheap Trick a few years longer, while all them became mods and dressed up and did the full scooter thing.
Yes.
Do you remember a lot of people dressing up, putting on the parkas and getting into it, or the super fans?
Yeah, no, it was wonderful. For me, it was... What was so cool is that, again, in Canada, it's very, very different from me growing up in the 70s in England. Because, again, like, the mods and the skinheads were basically arch enemies, right? If one mod was walking down the street and three skinheads, the mod will get beat up. There's no, you know, that's all there is to it. You know, it's a certain English mentality amongst youth and violence. Was out here, again, we'd have gigs and there'd be punks, there'd be skinheads, there'd be mods all dancing together in the same venue, whereas in England, that would never have happened. So for me, it was like, man, this is such a great place.
At the Soft Rock, you played with bands like, you know, Rubber Biscuit or the French Letters and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I loved those bands. You know, I loved those bands. Rubber Biscuit was... phenomenal. You know, John Beattie, Pat Stewart, Doug Elliott, and Brian Beattie. They're just phenomenal guys. They went on to form Big Medicine. Great band. French Letters, they were fun. It's funny that my manager, Dan Tolan, as you know him as, he basically managed all three of those bands, including me.
That's how I met him, actually, when I think I phoned to get the French Letters to play our high school. And you guys actually played a couple high school dances on the North Shore and North and West Vancouver that many of my friends attended. And I also attended, and you, of course, are Dave Neal of Skaboom playing this Sunday night at the Wise Hall. But in the 80s, you were in The Villains. Did you guys ever end up playing with any British ska bands when they came through town? You mentioned you missed playing with the Specials, but did you ever get any feedback from any British ska bands as they toured, or did any tour?
Not many toured. We have played with Bad Manners three times in Canada, once in Toronto, twice in Vancouver. Madness never came here, which was a real shame. You know, Canadians would have loved Madness. They were amazing. And they're now back together playing in London, right? The Specials, again, they came here with the Police in 81. For that one concert at the PNE. I was on tour, so I missed it, but again, they never came back. English Beat, we played with English Beat in Toronto, and that was a great gig, and the band loved our band. They loved the energy. You know, we were a very different energy than the English Beat, even though we liked what they did, but we were totally, we're way more in your face. They're way more melodic and fun. They're still playing. You know, Dave Wakelin was here, just a year ago was the last time I saw Dave Wakelin in the English Beat. But they played at Dixon Dix a year ago, so...
Because you mentioned you had a deal from Attic Records.
Yeah.
Did you ever tour out of Canada? Did you ever go down to L.A.? Because there was mention of this art in this article that also said you had a single on Stiff Records. I don't know if it's true or not, that you were going to maybe play L.A. with the Police.
No, we didn't play with the Police. We played L.A., we played New York. We played Seattle. We never played with the Police, no. That would have been a dream come true. I loved the Police around 80, 81, 82.
The Villains versus the Police would have been a good match.
It would have been fab, wouldn't it? It would have been... Oh, I would have loved it.
You had a bit of money behind you.
Money?
Yeah, you must have had a bit of money behind you. Because,
nothing.
Well, how about this thing happening in Toronto where you brought in all these, like, fish and chips people and you flew in all these? Like, how did that all come together? Who put that deal together?
Well, we just invited our local fish guy from East London, my mate, who owns the fish shop. We just said, look, we're doing this. Why don't you come for a holiday? And he said, all right. So he came over. That's what happened.
Oh, that's great.
No, I know. And the Pearly Kings and Queens, one of them was already in Toronto, so we said, oi, can you get... I think the Pearly King was in Toronto, and we said, look, can you get a Queen? So again, he rang up one of the ladies in East London and said, oi, come over for the boys. It was really a family thing where the band was poor since day one. when we arrived in Canada, we went straight to a cheap motel. After 3-4 gigs, we were basically forced to find a girlfriend to stay with because we had no money, right? So we were not ever a rich band. We were just young kids out for adventure. That's all we were.
But you will be rich this Sunday night when lots of people come out to see Skaboom and the Kingpins at the Wise Hall. So you got the deal with Attic Records. By this time, the Count, the singer guy, he had left. When did the Count left?
Yeah, he left basically October 1981. That's he was with the band for basically the first year, and then he went.
Where is he now? Whatever happened to him? Did he ever do any more music?
He did. He went to Toronto, and he tried one more band that was just together for a couple of months. And now, the last time I saw him was about 4 years ago in Vancouver, and he's not playing any music anymore.
So you became the singer then?
Yeah, it was one of those things where we had a Commodore gig, right? And Steve, the Count, basically came to the gig that night for sound check and just said, "Look, guys, I'm sick of being broke. I want all the money from this gig. Otherwise, I'm leaving." And at that point, like Jock, you know, Tom, you know, he had two kids, right? He had to pay his rent. And I was living with a girl, so I didn't have the rent problem. But we just said to Steve, you can't do this. We've got to pay the rent. You know, Jock's got his kids, right? Skank and Steve at the time needed money for medical, because none of us had medical, right? So he needed an operation. And we just said, "Steve, you can't do that to the band." And Steve, who was a bit more of a skinhead than the rest of us in the bad way, basically just said, "Look, you guys, fucking give me the money or I'm out." And so he left that day before the gig. So I started singing that night, basically.
When did the Attic deal come about, and had you been offered anything before that? You must have, playing all these packed houses, had some sort of offers on the table. And when you got the Attic deal, you were mentioning they wanted a pop album. Were you pressured to change? And that must have made you feel kind of hard, because you're going from this cool ska band to like almost like the Split Ends or something like that.
I know. Yeah, it was definitely a bad mistake on my behalf. When I look back to all the music I've recorded in my life, it's when I'm being true to myself is the music that I like the best. And I feel with the Go Crazy album, I was trying to be something that I'm not. So to me, that's why it's not a successful album. You know, we were pretending to be a pop, teeny pop album, a band, right? And that's not what we are. So,
were you offered any other deals before the Attic deal?
We were offered independent deals, but we thought we could do those ourselves anyway. And when the Attic deal came up, they basically said, "Look, we'll give you 50 grand if you record an album for us. But we want it to be more like this." And basically, even though we've been touring Canada at that point for, you know, 3.5 years nonstop, we were still, you know, we were broke.
Had you gone in the studio after recording the Life of Crime EP and before the Attic LP?
We've gone in the studio, just in relatively inexpensive studios, little 16-track studios. So I have cassettes of those tapes that have songs that I don't think anyone's ever heard. Well, not heard, just the people who were at my gigs at the time. You know, like songs like National Bank and Wrigley's Gum and those type of songs I do have on cassette tape from that era, which, you know, again, it makes me laugh when I listen to myself then, because I was way more cockney then, right? But it makes me laugh because the spirit and the essence of the band was true to itself. And I think that's, you know, it was a good, good band, right? So, yes, I've got tapes of that stuff.
When you got the Attic deal, I noticed on the back of the record, you had a songwriting partner. It said, like, Ernie McNally and Bron Farnon. Who are they?
Oh, Ernie. I know who Ernie is. I don't know who Ron is.
Bron.
Oh, Bron, yeah. Basically, Attic hired Bron to be our producer. So as producer, he wanted some songwriting royalties. That's what he wanted. Right? So we had to say, "Okay, Braun, yes, your name will be put on the album, and you will get a percentage of any royalties we make." That was his gig. Whereas Ernie McNally, for the songs, for the pop songs, you know, they're way more poppy on the songs that I wrote with Ernie. He was just a really good friend. He was a very good lyricist, right? And at the time, I was living near Ernie, and I just said to him, Ernie, look, I want to write a pop song. These are my ideas. I want to write a love song. Can you help me out, right? So he said, all right. So I gave him the melody I had and the ideas for words, and he basically helped me complete that.
Friends of mine remember going to the Go Crazy video release party at the Vancouver East Cultural Center.
Yeah.
And I guess they were a tiny bit disappointed, I guess, because that was the introduction almost of the new era, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The new era. But when I look back at that Go Crazy video,
Yeah. It
is outrageous. Like, it's hilarious because it's like these... Not these, like, two-tone ska girls chasing after you guys. It's like these Madonna wannabes, and, like, they're climbing up this giant ladder, and the camera, like, focuses right in on their ass.
I know!
It's like, what the hell is going on here? But that was played quite a bit, like, on video hits.
I know! It was every time I see that now, I blush with embarrassment, even today.
Well, how about back then were you blushing?
I was. Because, again, this was one of those things we were temporarily... Again, I think a lot of bands have done this. So, basically, all musicians out there, look, just stick to your guns. Just do exactly what you want to do. Do not listen to record companies. Do not listen to people who think they can make you money and make you into pop stars because they're a load of wankers. Just stick to your guns and do what you enjoy doing, all right? That's my advice to the young musicians out there. But again, we were with the video, the records company saying, we want this look, we want this, we want to get this on Much Music, we want to get this on, this is what we need, we need this type of format, we need this type of good looking birds. And we're going, no, like, you're taking it too far. And they're going, look, we know the business. You guys may know a little bit about music, but we know business. So we listened to them like fools, and that's what we were.
How long was it before the band disintegrated and then basically turned into Skaboom? Or what happened? What ended? And what was the reaction when you sort of pumped that album? Were the older fans upset or were they totally alienated and didn't even come out to the gigs? And did you do any of the older stuff live still?
We did, yeah. We basically, what we did is we took from the album, we basically, we played six songs from that Go Crazy album live, and all the rest was the original Villain stuff, so... There were, I definitely had comments from quite a few fans that were saying, Dave, you wanker, why have you sold out, right? And I basically, as I do now, I just agreed with them and said, yeah, I know, I've made a mistake there. But I only saw that in hindsight. At the time, I thought, okay, you know, here I am, I've been, you know, fucking working, you know, 5-6 nights a week in this band for 4 years, right? You know, we haven't made a cent, right? And then there's a record company say, hey, don't worry, listen to us. You know, you'll actually get some money out of this, and you can keep playing, because that's all I really wanted to do at the time, was just be a musician. That was my goal, right? So, yeah, no, we definitely we were foolish on that count, and those fans did come up to me and said, yeah, Dave, what you're doing, we liked you better before. But then we had this whole new audience, and that was the amazing thing. We had this whole new audience that watched Much Music, and suddenly we're having all these trendy girls and trendy boys come into our gigs who had seen us on TV. So it was quite strange.
At what point, though, did everything end? I mean, how did it end?
Oh, basically, what?
Like, was there one thing? Like, to me, was like, it's the ass shot in the Go Crazy video. That is the end.
Oh yeah.
For me, but for you guys, how long did it keep going? How long did Attic keep pumping the album? At what point did Attic said, "Sorry, guys, we're giving up. There's not another album." Or was there another album on the deal?
Oh yeah, there was going to be another album on the deal. Basically, all what happened is we that came out late '84. We toured '85. We toured '86 until the last tour was May '86, and in April '86 I became landed. Okay, so I did not have to tour. I could get off this machine for the first time in 5.5 years. Right, I could actually, if I wanted to, I could stop touring. I could stop living with these musicians every day. Right, these same four guys who who I'd seen every day for 5.5 years, and I needed to get out, is what happened. So I just said to the guys, that's it for the band, because I was exhausted.
When did Ska Boom start up?
So what happened then? That was 1986. So then what I did is I took a job in Expo, right, being a lighting guy. I'm still a lighting guy, right, doing the stage lighting and stuff. And I took a job doing that at 86th Street. So that was great. I got my own place. I was working, getting a paycheck. But then I missed Ska. So then what I did is I got together with John Beattie, who we mentioned earlier from Rubber Biscuit. Do you remember that band?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well, I got together with John. I said, John, I got to do one more ska band, mate. It's in me. So John Beattie and I formed Ska Boom. That's what we did. It was our idea at the time just to do ska and find obscure pop songs that we could make into good ska songs.
At what point did you notice a ska revival starting up again? Like when you got in contact with Scotty from Scotty's Scenic Drive, who's presenting your band Ska Boom this Sunday night with the Kingpins at the Y. So, of course, you are Dave Neal, originally of The Villains. At what point did you notice a ska revival happening or interest in The Villains? Because you've been actually covered by Chris Murray, one of the influential Canadian ska stars out there.
Yeah, I don't know whether there's an actual... There seems to be waves of revivals. There seems to be every couple of years a few good bands that come out. And so I don't know whether there is a brand new wave or a brand new revival happening now. The reason I play is because I love it. But right now, that's the only reason. We don't make any money. We won't make any money on Sunday the 6th with this fantastic gig with the Kingpins. This Sunday at the Wise Hall, we won't make any money. You know, once I've paid for rehearsal, we probably lose money. At the moment, I'm just playing because I love to get on stage and play this type of music. That's why I'm doing it.
Where are the rest of the villains right now? Are there any other villains in Ska Boom, Dave?
No, they're not. Basically, the other villains, two villains are now in England. Tommy, the bass player, and Skankin' Steve, they moved back to England. And Jockstrap, as you say, he is in Canada teaching in Richmond. And Count Steve, the original singer, he basically, I believe he's either in Vancouver or Toronto. I haven't heard from him in many years.
I was just thinking, you touring the country all those times, back and forth, the towns you played, you're playing, you know, as a ska band, they probably never even saw a punk band before.
Oh, yeah, we played little places like Esterhazy, Saskatchewan, which is 1,000 people population. And we'd go into the little town hall, and everyone would be there, right? You get your little kids, teenagers, mums and dads, grandma, grandpa. Everyone's there to watch The Villains. And this was in 1981, right? So it was pretty wild.
Anything else you want to add to the people out there at all, Dave Neal of The Villains, aside for coming out on Sunday night at the Wise Hall to go see Ska Boom? They'll see some Villain songs in Ska Boom, won't they?
I just want to talk about Ska Boom itself. The other guys in the band, you know, it seems to be a lot about me, and obviously I love that because I haven't done any interviews or talked about myself in years. But I want to mention the other guys in the band. You know, Ska Boom, basically, when we formed in 87, what we did is we found the best three horn players we could find, right, who were into the music, we're into creating new stuff. And these guys are all jazz guys, right? So our horn section is phenomenal, right? These guys are the best musicians in the band. Our trombone player, Bruce, is a killer. He's phenomenal. He's the best bone player I've ever heard. You got to hear this guy. He writes superb, quirky horn lines. In our band, the way we do it is our horn guys write all their own stuff. That's what they do. Even if we're doing a cover song, we will add our own arrangements on all our original Ska Boom songs. Bruce, you know, he writes all that stuff. And when you've got a killer musician in your band, you want him to be creative, right? So that's what Bruce does. Our sax player, Graham, is just phenomenal. Our trumpet player, Kev, he's a teacher in Surrey, for all you Surrey kids out there. Kevin Lee, again, a great player. On our rhythm section, we got the Grant brothers. We've got Chris Grant, who used to be in Big Medicine. We've got his brother Lee Grant, who used to be with the band Pure. He was Pure's drummer for 4 years when they were super big. On the keyboards, we got Dexter, Ross Cameron. Again, this guy is a wonderful and quirky and creative musician, a fabulous guy. I love this band. This band is great. In my mind, you know, the band musically is way better than the Villains ever were. We're a lot older, right? So, you know, you gain certain things with age and you lose other things, right? But musically and tightness and togetherness, Skaboom is a great ska band.
And check them out this Sunday night at the Wise Hall with the Kingpins. And thank you very much, Dave. I really appreciate you phoning into the Nardwuar Human Serviette radio show here today. It really is a pleasure to speak to you because I've really been severely influenced by the Villains and Skaboom and your legacy. Just by you keeping alive and wanting to play music has allowed me to be able to speak to you, because if you weren't playing music now, I probably wouldn't be hooking up with you. So thank you for the Skabooming. But the Villains, the EP, that is perhaps one of the greatest bits of Canadian wax ever laid down. And we're going to end here with Life of Crime. Might get a chance to follow it up with Go Crazy, because I do have a little guilty spot for the Go Crazy as well. It's just so awesome and over the top. I just love it in that way. But anything else you want to add to the people out there at all?
I just want to say, any of you skanksters down there, yeah, come out, check out Skaboom. I know you're going to love the band. If you want to dance, you know, that's what we do. We really lay down the groove. We've got it down pat. We've been, you know, I've been playing ska music now for 25 years, right? Which is a long time. I'm aging myself, but I play it because I love it, and I'll probably play it until I die, because that's what I want to do.
And I'd love to get a tape of the Wrigley's Gum tune to play on CITR to the listeners. Maybe one day we can hook up and get that.
I'll see what I can find for you, Nob. Well, absolutely.
Or any of the outtakes, because the recordings of the EP are so good, too. Like, the recordings. And that live, that National Bank clip, it sounded really good. Like, I think that was a live clip of you guys.
It is live. Yeah, we played that live.
Well, thanks so much, Dave. Keep on rocking in the free world, and doot doodaloo doo.
Doot, doot.
All right, thanks. See ya.
See ya, Noah.
I just got out of jail today, so I thought I'd go down the back street way, send the gear on a market stall, looking at where's to one end all.
Life or crime? Life or crime?
I really love this.
Life of crime. Life of crime. Life of crime.
I must be hooked on my life of crime. At night I go on a shopping spree, and a western with my skeleton key. Watches diamonds, gold and jewels. I fix myself what bloody fools.
Life of crime. Life of crime.
I really love this.
Life of crime.
I pick the street, then choose her house. Climb up the train quite quiet than a mouse. In through the window and out through the door. Then I down the street, get off it once more.
Life of crime. Life of crime.
I really love this.
Life of crime.
But I fix myself as my heart then beats. What's that noise in a far off street? That sounds too friendly, so off I go. I'm down the tube station, but far from home.
Size 12 feet through the midnight air, as the boys from Blue come from everywhere. The hand feels my collar as the cuffs go on, and you know what happens from there in on.
Life of crime. Life of crime.
I really love this.
Life of crime. Life of crime. life of crime.
Just back to prison to do my
life of crime.
Time.
Do my time.
Time.
Life of crime.
And you're still listening to CITR Radio, FM 102, Cable 102, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And coming up right after this tune, the CITR News. That was the Villains from 1981 with Life of Crime. And now here's the Villains from 1984 with Go Crazy. Oh, and if you want any free tickets to the gig this Sunday night, 822-2487 UBC CITR to go see Skaboom featuring Dave from the Villains and the Kingpins. But here's the Go Crazy album and the track Go Crazy by the Villains.